Hey, Tacoma, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're talking with Dr. Greta Turnbull. She's a professor of philosophy at Gonzaga University. Science and the scientific method are areas of focus for her. Science has given us so much, really just about everything we enjoy in our current lifestyle has its roots in science, whether it's light bulbs, cars, internet, the clothes we wear, and on and on. We owe a lot to science. Yet science is under attack from some quarters around issues like climate change and inoculations, for instance. I think one of the key problems is that we as lay people look at the world and how we decide what's factual in a very different way than do scientists. So that's going to be my primary focus with Dr. Turnbull today. Due to the length of my conversation, I'm dividing it into two parts. So today, part one, here we go. Greta Turnbull, welcome to Climate Talk. It's great to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So just briefly, Greta's a professor of science at Gonzaga University. And of course, science and what we do with science is a big deal when we think about climate change, which is what we're going to be talking about to an extent today, the intersection of philosophy of science and climate change. So Greta, let's start off. Why don't you say a little bit about why of all things you could have picked in the universe, you picked to be a philosopher and particularly of science?
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting because I was thinking about this and I look back at when I was like in my biology class, my first biology class, which must have been I was like 12 or 13 or 14. And the things I was really interested in that biology class weren't just the science. Like I was really fascinated by biology, but I was really interested in, we had a big discussion of evolutionary biology, a unit on evolutionary biology. And the thing that was fascinating to me about that unit was that we were talking about how science is used a lot in society, how it's perceived, because evolution, as we all know, is sort of a hot button topic in American popular culture, in addition to being a very important scientific field. And so I was really fascinated by these conversations we're having about, like, how do we trust science? When do we trust science? What makes science trustworthy? What kind of authority does science have in society? And how do we evaluate that kind of authority? When is it overstepping? When are we not giving it enough authority? And so I didn't really know that was philosophy of science, obviously, as a teenager. Yeah. But when I got to my doctoral program, one of the things I really had questions about that motivated me were those questions that I kept coming back to about, like, how do we use science? I knew that I wasn't called to be a bench scientist. I knew that the lab wasn't what got me up in the mornings, but I was really still those questions about what gives science and how do we use a thoroughly human enterprise that is science to the best of our human ability. And so those questions were really fascinating to me. And then eventually I ended up in some philosophy of science courses. And philosophy of science is such a massive discipline. It's got so many incredibly brilliant people. A lot of the people I work with have two PhDs. They have a PhD in the scientific field, as well as a PhD in philosophy. And I do not. So I just have a philosophy PhD. So it was just it's a fascinating field because you have just incredibly brilliant people who are thinking about science from the perspective of science itself. They're doing the science and then they're thinking about how we use it. I'm still fascinated by those questions. And now I get to teach courses at Gonzaga that help students who are moving into the science, technology, engineering, and mathematical grad programs get ready to think about how they're using science and how science and society relate, but right before they get into those programs. So it's a really unique job, and I really love it.
Yeah, so full disclosure here, I took an intro to philosophy of science at the University of Washington back in the 70s. And the thing that triggered that thought for me was the notion that people from, let's call it the hard sciences, a lot of them, they've kind of got to go and take that philosophy of science course if they want to or not. And I remember my class was about half and half liberal arts majors and engineers and those kind of folks. And one of the things I remember is that the engineers were just pretty much irritated through the entire course.
Yes, I get that. Actually, I teach a lot of engineers. And the funny thing that the students say is that they often enter the class with a very particular, we call it an image of science. So what they think science looks like or is at its best. And they come in with a particular view of that. And then they leave with a very different picture. And my engineers especially often talk about how thinking about the role of science in society really challenges them to dig deeper into the ethical aspects of their professions, because a lot of them are going directly into construction engineering programs where they are designing things that human beings are going to rely on. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting, I think once we take a deep breath and think, oh, I'm actually thinking about science as society doesn't threaten science, it actually makes science better, then that can be a really profoundly transformative moment for a lot of students who work in those fields.
Yeah, of course, the intro to philosophy of science at Duke, it was a lower division course, a 201 or something like that. But strangely, at least it seems strange to me sometimes, it had an impact, a lifelong impact on me. I mean, I think about that course quite a bit and some of the light bulbs that went off for me about things. So I'm like, man, that seems like it's the case. And I just never thought about it before. So maybe that's a little bit of what we can accomplish for listeners today. So I know this is a huge question that I'm asking you, but maybe we can just do the sub Reader's Digest version. And that is, what exactly, no, take it back. What approximately is the scientific method?
Yeah. So I think there are so many answers to this question. And I think that the kind of answer we give to the question really impacts how authoritative we think science is, or what kind of thing we treat science as people who do not practice science. And so I think the scientific method is an organized way that people work together to the best of our human ability, answer and ask questions about the world around us in a way that does its absolute human best to remove the possibility of error. Now, I should probably, actually, I would say not remove, but reduce the possibility of error, okay, right? Yeah. Because it's a collective thing. I think the thing that the way that we pursue those questions together is often what reduces that possibility of error. But it's still, and I say possibility intentionally, there's still almost a probability. Like, there's still going to be error involved in it. And I think one of the crises we had in American culture for the last, I mean, in all sorts of different areas for a very long time has been, well, science makes mistakes. Does that mean it's not science? And I think that's more, that crisis is more to blame for what we thought science was at the beginning, and that we had a mistaken view of what science was to begin with, rather than a fault of the current science we've got going or the mistakes.
So how far back are you going in that concept of what we thought science was at the time?
Oh my gosh, I think I could go back pretty far, pretty far. Yeah. One of my favorite pieces in the philosophy of science was written in, I believe, 1903. And one of my favorite, the reason I love it so much, it's a 3-page paper by a professor named Richard Rudner. And the whole point of the paper is that in the 1950s, he's recognizing they have this view of science as this sort of like, the scientist is a man, of course, because that, you know, he's a white man with, he says, thin rimmed spectacles, who is impassionately making decisions in a lab free from, you know, free from judgment, free from the possibility of error. And he's recognizing that they had like, that's sort of the image of science that was going on then. And I think, oh my gosh, that's the kind of image I talk about with my students all the time, right? I ask them at the beginning of the classes I teach science and technology studies, I say, what do you think science is? Is science perfectly objective? And most of them say, yes, science is perfectly objective. And I say, oh, okay, so are you perfectly objective? And they say, no. And then I say, okay, so do you do science? And then all of them raise their hands and talk about the different lab research they're involved in at Gonzaga. And I think, okay, well, we have a little bit of a problem here because we're sort of expecting something out of science. We have this vision of science as this impartial, perfectly objective, like neutral, I think is a really important word there, neutral space. But it's actually a thoroughly, and so I think that we've wanted to believe that science has this sort of superhuman capabilities, that it has really incredible human capabilities. But I think we've wanted to believe in a science savior superhero. But I think it rises a lot in the aftermath of the Cold War. I think that's where you see a lot of that sort of grow because of our need to think of through scientific ways in which like we might actually end our planet. That was a big moment with the nuclear crisis. So I do think that it rises then, but I think a really long time. I mean, Descartes comes along the scene and says he solved most of the problems, you know, through his careful math and science. Like, that's a pretty far step back there. Yeah.
Yeah. So actually going back to the 50s isn't that far back. I mean, I remember the 50s. I know that a lot of people in the world don't, but it's strange to think that even as recently as the 50s, there was this notion of sort of infallibility of science.
Oh,
we
yes.
don't make mistakes, and so on and so forth. So one of the things that, this, I think it's still a problem today because science does, it changes its mind. I mean, if that's a fair thing to say, it's like,
yes.
oh, well, what we thought was true, it turns out it's not true.
Absolutely.
And also, you know, the mistakes are made. And I mean, there are papers published all the time that after those papers are out there for a while, there are things that are pretty clearly errors of one kind or the other in those papers. And so I think lay people view that all as a weakness. But I mean, really, shouldn't we view that as a strength?
Oh, absolutely. I think about if you had a friend, if I said, I can give you two friends, you have a choice, okay? Friend A is going to tell you that they're right 100% of the time, right? They'll never admit they're wrong, right? Or friend B will, you know, maybe not give you as confident of advice, but will admit that they're wrong when they're wrong. Which are you going to pick, right?
Right.
I would always pick the friend B, right? And I think science is a friend, right? Science, actually, the fact that it admits that it's wrong should give us reason to trust it, not reason to look at it with. We should be much more suspicious. You know, I also have done a lot of my other areas of interest are in the ways in which we get knowledge in social groups. And so I think a lot about weird social groups like cult. And a cult leader is someone who tells you they're never wrong, right?
Yeah.
Like that, you know, they're, whatever they say is right. And I hope that science never resembles a cult leader,
yeah.
right? That would be a reason to look at it very suspicious. That's not what we have when science is done well. We have a friend that says, oh, I get it wrong a lot of the time and I'm with it.
So let's play with that notion of suspicion here for just a second, because the subject that we're talking about, there are a lot of people in our culture who take that and use that as a doorway into disbelief in science. They say, well, you know, the scientists are always changing their mind and they make mistakes and they're human beings just like I am. So why should I pay any attention to them? In fact, I've heard people quoted in the media simply just saying, I don't trust the scientists. So how do we sort that one out?
Well, I think it's hard because I think that it's both a public perception of science problem as well as a science problem. I think sometimes science oversells what we're able to do. I think sometimes we say, don't worry, we're not going to change our mind on this. We're like, we get that cult leader vibe a little bit, right? We say, don't worry, we've got this. This we trust. And then you give us about, you know, 5 years and something insane yeah. happens and we learn more about that, right? And so I think that the best scientists that I know and that I work with are people who are deeply humble and people who are eager to admit when they've gotten something wrong. I don't think science has always been that good friend. I don't think we have always been eager to admit. And because of that, I think sometimes when science has admitted that it's gotten things wrong, it kind of comes out of the blue. It's like, wait a minute, you told me to keep believing you, right? This is out of the ordinary, right? I think about that sometimes when I talk to people who are suspicious of the masking requirements because the CDC originally said, don't worry about it. And now the CDC is, you know, saying, no, these are required in public spaces. I remember watching that and I have some empathy with people who are like, what in the world? You told me I should always trust you. And now you're saying you got it wrong. So I think sometimes in science, we need to be better at saying, like, not being afraid of talking about the replication crisis, for example, in psychology. And I also think if scientists and people who work in science studies are good about talking, I think especially now we have this whole new job of a science communicator, someone who goes into the media
right.
and communicates what the scientists are thinking and where we're at with our current science. If we have good science communicators, if we're good at that, I think there's going to be less about why, what in the world, you know, the current science on climate change says, because we're able to say, this is our current science. This is what we're thinking through. This is all the stuff we have evidence for right now. Isn't this concerning? And have it be listened to in a particular way that it might not have been if all we just do is go in there and say, oh, listen, you know, you always should trust us. You always did trust us, right? Here's what we're saying now. So I think a lot of it has to do with our posture. That said, I don't blame everything on the scientists themselves by any means. I think that we are struggling as a culture to reckon with public trust in all sorts of, think about this with government. I think about this with healthcare, all sorts of different instances right now. We're struggling with public trust. Who do we trust? When do we trust them? And is that trust somehow politically tinged, right? Like being a member of a political party, doesn't mean I trust some of these institutions and not others. That to me feels more like a human crisis than a scientific crisis. I see that all over. And so I think a lot of that is going to be, whether that will be solved or how that gets solved, is going to be determined by whether I think we're willing to look at the people who differ from us as fully, if we're willing to hear them out, to hear their differences and to welcome their differences and have conversations with them about where we come. Because I have a lot of students come into my classes. I teach a first year class on how to deal with people who disagree with you. And they say, well, the people who disagree with me hate me. I say, I'm sure that they do. And I'm sure you hate them, right? Like, this is like, if you go on social media, you can see this in less than 30 seconds. You can find someone who probably hates you, right? That we talk about it all the time with them. That prevents them from having any real conversations with that person. That prevents them from going out to the cafeteria with that person, right? It prevents them, that sort of environment prevents them from having the conversation that actually might be formative for someone's perception of the way that where climate science is right now, right? So I think that's also very much it there. I'm not sure if that answered your question, but those are my
general thoughts. Absolutely, it did. So I think there's so much in there. The subject of who to trust is just critically important. In fact, I do community presentations, and one part of those presentations is, we're not scientists ourselves, we're not experts ourselves, yet we have to make these important decisions, about how do we think our society is going to go. So, in determining who we trust, and of course, most people get their, let's call it, information from the media in one way or the other, social media, cable news, various, a lot of internet kind of related stuff. Mm-hmm. And the simple truth is that if a person starts out with a particular point of view, they can go on the internet and find support for that point of view. So let's just take the media, for example. Let's take a legit publication, like let's say USA Today, and there's some article in there about climate change or some other scientific aspect. So how would you advise a person reading that opinion, let's call it an opinion piece or something related to that? How would you advise a person to parse out whether they should be believing that or not?
Oh, I mean, that's a million-dollar question. I think I'm a person who studies belief for a living, and I have no idea what the correct answer is. This is literally my day job. But I think something I work with my students is I always ask them, I say, we do this exercise at the beginning of the semester where I ask them to open up their social media. So wherever they're getting their news. Mm-hmm. And then I ask them to spend like 5 minutes on a post-it note writing down the things that they learned from that. It is absolutely fascinating. Just like you've said, it's really funny, and I get them to laugh about it, how all of their political beliefs or social beliefs or religious beliefs are affirmed by what their social media tells them. They don't hear anything from the other side. One of my friends, Teen Wen, is a philosopher at the University of Utah, and he's worked a lot on thinking through what he calls echo chambers, chambers where we only hear the side that we want to hear, and the other side is labeled bad, evil, and stupid. And so one of my things that I'm always working with for myself is I always commit to my students that I will follow people on social media during the course of the semester whose beliefs I completely disagree. And it is very funny because I do this every semester. And yet when I see those people on my Twitter feed, I think, why am I following that person? Right? why is that opinion on my, and then I remember, oh, this is like a thing I committed to them to do, right? Yeah. And I think if we're not doing that, that feels absolutely scary, right? I am like always in shock when it comes on my Twitter feed. I'm like, why? But when we're doing that, it absolutely fundamentally changes over time, like helps rewire our brain, I think, to allow us to see those other people as well. I grew up in a very closed religious community. And so I talk to my students about this experience a lot because they get very curious. They ask me all sorts of questions about it. But what I tell them is most crucial is that the things that changed my mind that led me to exit that closed religious community were not people coming to telling me, oh, here you go. Like, you just don't trust science enough or whatever, right? It was people who came to me without agenda, who were my friends, who cared about me as a person, whether I ever left that community or not. And those people fundamentally changed. They saw me as a person and I learned to see them as a person, even though they would have been labeled bad, stupid, right? By the people I was reading growing up. And that fundamentally formed me as a person. And you hear this a lot from people who leave cults, right? It wasn't the people who came to them with these knockdown arguments. My students are always looking for knockdown arguments. Yeah. They're always asking me, well, you know, I have this friend, you know, anti-vax, how do I talk to them? What's the best argument you've got, Dr. Dermal? And I say, there is none. Like that argument you're looking for does not exist. What the best thing you can do is go have lunch with them and talk about the weather. Like, you know, like it's, or whatever else, right? Talk about our new Gonzaga's basketball team is something you could always talk about, right?
Yeah, right?
Talk about something and actually be interested and care about them without agenda. Because that is the only, this idea that we can sort of come in and be like, oh, I can readjust your belief forming mechanism. It's like, good luck. You know, psychologists have been trying to do it for a while. I don't think it's that easy.
Yeah, that is one of the great myths of our cultural system. And it's something that I've just figured out in the last few years myself. And one of the things that, one aspect of what you're talking about there, I've heard this attributed to Socrates. I have never been able to track it down, but that Socrates said, people are most convinced by that which they discover for themselves. And so that, I mean, I know that that's true about me, and it's, yes. I believe it's true about other people. I mean, if somebody tries to hammer me with something, it makes me resist more than...
Absolutely. And one of the authors I love calls that the oh heck no moment, right? Like, you know, you're told, like, I remember being told when I was living in my close religious community, I remember being told, like, what you believe is stupid. And I remember thinking, oh, it is, huh? Like, you know, that's not going to, that person, I think they probably had the best of intentions, but they were not helping me at all. And if anything, they drew me, you know, this idea of polarization, they drew me closer into the more extreme belief rather than bringing me out towards the middle.
Yeah. Just thinking back in my college days too, there was one of my fellow students had a sticker on his notebook that said, just because you've silenced me doesn't mean you've convinced me.
Oh, brilliant. Yes.
Yeah.
And absolutely.
So that's what we're talking about, at least to an extent. So you've made a couple allusions to evolution. I just want to ask you culturally, biologically, the evidence I see says that we've evolved over time. We're not the same as we were at some time in the past.
Yes.
So here is a key question in my mind, and that is, have we as a species evolved the ability to deal with this challenge of climate change or not?
Oh, I don't think we have by any means. But I wondered sometimes if we're getting closer to it, right? And especially because I feel like I get a front row seat. I work with the next generation, right? I get to work with the next, you know, I think 1% of the world's population goes to college, right? They call it the powerful one. Like, I think those students, you don't need to tell them that they need to care about climate. When I'm evaluating admissions applications, I work with our Gonzaga's Honors Program a lot. These students are doing climate projects to change and better the environment on their own. You know, like, this is what they bring to our campus, is a deep concern for the environment. So I'd love to attribute that to we're changing as a species, and now we're, you know, we're reckoning it, because I see evidence of that. Yeah, so I hope so, but I don't think we're taking it nearly seriously enough for things to, like, make a, you know, we humans love to talk a big game. We're really good at that.
Yeah. So let's just break there. This is the first part of my conversation with Dr. Turnbull. I really appreciate her depth of understanding of the scientific process and how that intersects with the culture. I also greatly appreciate her passion for the topic and her ability to maintain a sense of humor throughout what could be a pretty brittle subject. The next episode of Climate Talk will have part two, concluding my conversation with Dr. Turnbull. You can contact me at John, J-O-H-N, at cclTacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out, a bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under Programming. So until we talk again, remember, always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.